I'm Calman Bland, and I welcome you to this set of 10 lectures introducing Jewish mysticism. By introducing Jewish mysticism, I mean making it familiar, a little less mysterious, daunting, or baffling. I mean describing what made Jewish mysticism possible or attractive, even compelling to its adherents, and altogether implausible, perhaps even repellent, to its opponents. These lectures are therefore not intended to pass judgment on Jewish mysticism, to decide whether it is morally good or morally bad, to determine whether Jewish mysticism is the product of healthy-minded religious virtuosos or the product of pathologically diseased, unbalanced, psychotic kooks, or to pronounce Jewish mysticism philosophically true and valid, or empirically nonsense, or to declare Jewish mysticism authentically Jewish, perhaps the quintessential Judaism, or to declare Jewish mysticism something which is un-Jewish as a thing could be. To avoid passing these judgments, and the temptation to do that sort of thing is overwhelming, we need some sort of antidote to keep in check the tendency to want to decide whether something is good or bad morally, or true or false philosophically. To avoid doing all of that and to stick to the business of making Jewish mysticism slightly more familiar, I propose to deal with two questions in and out of this first lecture and throughout all 10 of them. And the two questions are fairly straightforward. The first question is, what is Jewish about Jewish mysticism? And the second question is, what is mystical about Jewish mysticism? Well, to some, these two questions are rude or impertinent or inane. So I need at the outset to make some clarification of why I think I'm asking these questions and to make other disclaimers about what can and can't be accomplished in these lectures. Well, what about the claim that these two questions are rude or impertinent? What is Jewish about Jewish mysticism? If we were to ask the Jewish mystics themselves from within the tradition what's Jewish about Jewish mysticism, they would say that that's a categorical mistake, that Judaism and Jewish mysticism are tantamount to being the same thing, that they're synonyms, that the true meaning of Jewish belief and practice, the true goal and objective of Jewish life, are precisely those things which are defined and described in the Jewish mystical tradition. They are one and the same. The secrets of Jewish mysticism were first revealed to Abraham, before Abraham to Adam, in the very Garden of Eden, according to some of the Jewish mystics themselves. So to ask what is Jewish about Jewish mysticism from the tradition's own point of view is somewhat absurd. To ask what is mystical about it wouldn't even make any sense, because I'm not sure that the mystics themselves were aware that they were mystics. They were just Jews. And that would be the answer from within the tradition. But I don't mean in these lectures to reproduce Jewish mysticism per se. And so I need to make a historian's disclaimers about what the objectives of these 10 introductory lectures is. What can be accomplished? Well, a set of 10 introductory lectures on Jewish mysticism is no substitute for Jewish mysticism itself, not because a mere 10 45-minute lectures are too few and too short to do justice to the subject, but because these lectures separate the living reality of Jewish mysticism from its natural habitat. A parable. Unto what might the thing be likened? Something like a zoo. Even a zoo that spares no effort in reproducing the natural environment of the animals that it displays for us in their captivity. Observing animals in a zoo is not the same as observing them in the wild, in their own natural home. The zoo conveys some idea of what the animal might be like in its native habitat. And the more the zoo strives to recreate the natural environment, the more accurate our impression will be. The less like a prisoner's cell with concrete floors and iron bars separating us from the animals, the less it's like a zoo, the more accurate the impression will be. But there is no substitute for observing wildlife in its native habitat. And these lectures, in a sense, are a zoo in which Jewish mysticism has been extricated and detached and separated from the living cultural context of its life. And these lectures are something like a zoo or like a museum of fine arts or a museum of ethnography, in which an artifact produced by a culture is detached from its living place and put on display for us. Or these lectures are like what happens at Carnegie Hall when a Bach cantata, which was originally composed with the intention of being heard and performed in the religious setting of a church on the Sunday before Easter, meaning one thing in its own context, being played in the concert hall means something altogether different. So these lectures are something like a zoo, one that hopefully tries to reproduce the natural environment as best as it can, something like a museum in which a cultural artifact is detached from its cultural setting, and something like a concert hall where a piece of music which originally was composed for something else is displayed for an audience. I'm not suggesting that zoos or museums and concert halls be closed down and that lectures on Jewish mysticism be eliminated and erased from memory before they're even conceived. I'm only suggesting that we ought not to confuse the natural habitat of the animal or the original setting of a piece of art on an altar in a church or a Bach cantata for the way it appears to us in the contrived setting of a zoo or a museum or a concert hall. Being placed in these settings allows us to see certain things about the object and obscures other aspects of it. Religious art placed in an art museum next to art taken from different cultures and different times makes apparent and obvious certain aesthetic characteristics of the art, which we might not have seen had we heard them in their original context. So it's a trade-off. But that's what the academic study of religion is in general, and what the academic study of Jewish mysticism is in particular. It's something of a zoo, hopefully one that tries to reproduce to create a good context for the artifact, but not to be confused for the thing itself. The study of religion is not the same as the practice of religion, which leads me to a second disclaimer. A set of 10 45-minute lectures, or even 100 or 1,000 90-minute lectures, has a very distinct set of goals from the life of religion itself. Another parable unto what may the thing be likened. To a music conservatory or to an art school in which one learns how to make paintings or sculpture or prints, or one learns how to make and perform music. These sorts of things are in sharp contrast to classes or courses in art history or art appreciation or music history or music appreciation in which one learns how to hear or how to see, but certainly not how to make. So this set of lectures too, this example of an academic study of something of religion, won't teach us how to make Jewish mysticism and won't turn us into Jewish mystics. For that, one would need to go to a Jewish community that actually lives that life, to a living reality. So this course can't do that. It doesn't pretend to make Jewish mysticism or to make Jewish mystics. But it does hope to fulfill its own objectives and its own virtues, which is to learn how to see Jewish mysticism, how to hear it, and to make it slightly less baffling. There's a lovely story told in the 19th century Hasidic tradition, which I think captures what the goal of a course like this could be. A deaf man walked into a village and saw in the village square people piled around, holding hands, grasping shoulders, and dancing and gesticulating wildly, having a pretty good time. The deaf man looked at all of the people in the village square and was a bit puzzled by what he saw, and decided that this town must be filled with fools and idiots, people who just jump around for no rhyme or reason. After a few minutes, though, the crowd dispersed, and the deaf man saw that in the center of the crowd there was a violinist who apparently had been playing such wonderful music that the people were caught in the rhythms and the melodies and moved in response to them. The deaf man realized that he had jumped to a conclusion. What he thought was senseless, ridiculous behavior had meaning once he saw that they were responding to music. Well, hopefully that's what this set of lectures can do, to give some sense of what the music is that Jewish mystics heard that caused them to behave in the way that they did. Well, then back to the tradition itself. The tradition says that Jewish mysticism and Judaism are one and the same, and that the mysteries of its belief and the significance of its practices are identical to those of Judaism itself. If not identical, then perhaps as form-fitting as a good glove that goes over one's hand or a suit of clothes that fits one body. They conform. They're not identical, but they interlock with one another. They overlap. That's the tradition's answer itself. There are some modern people who believe the same thing. For example, if we read Martin Buber, the great 20th century Jewish religious thinker, and his early essays at the beginning of the 20th century on what the nature of Judaism is, Martin Buber would say that the essence of Jewish religiosity, and by religiosity he meant the spirit, the inner kernel of Jewish life, as opposed to its religious practices, the external forms, that if we wanted to identify the essence of Jewish religiosity, we would begin with the Bible and we would find the prophets. And from the prophets, we would find this spirit being handed down to the early mystics, and from the early mystics to the Essenes and the early Christian movement. And then down through Jewish history, this Jewish spirituality, this religiosity, would be preserved in a subterranean way by heretics and mystics down throughout the ages, surfacing in the 19th and 18th century Jewish Hasidic movement, and I guess coming to life again in the thinking of people like Martin Buber. Buber then is a modern example of a traditional answer that the core, the quintessence of Judaism, of its spirit, is Jewish mysticism. But that's the view from the inside, and I already made the disclaimers that we're not going to try to give the view from the inside. We are observers in a zoo, or tourists in a museum, or an audience in a concert hall. We're not trying to reproduce Jewish mysticism and to decide whether or not it is authentically Jewish or not, whether it is the heart and the essence of the tradition. We want to understand it a little bit. And the way that I propose to understand it is to use a historian's framework. Historians, unlike people from within the tradition, are interested in four sorts of things. They're very interested and attuned to evidence of change over time, how something might begin but evolve under different circumstances, how horizontally in history things might take different forms, how vertically throughout history one institution or one set of beliefs would undergo an evolution. Historians are on the lookout for change and development. The tradition from within is not as attuned to change, and when it is, it feels that it's a slipping away from the essence. So the historian wants to look for change. The historian wants to look for diversity. The historian knows that there is no such thing as a uniform, monolithic, uniform anything of human life. The historian is also interested in understanding things as the result of interactivity. The tradition would say that Jewish mysticism or Judaism was handed down intact from on high and given to human beings, and that human beings were passive and receptive. The historian says that that's a little bit simplified because all things in history happen as a result of interactivity. human beings may have received, but in receiving they also change and alter. It's often said that religion needs to be relevant to the changing circumstances of human life. And as Jewish history changed and the conditions of Jewish life altered, so did the original revelation, if it ever was given in the form that the tradition says so, change as well. The fourth thing that a historian is extraordinarily attuned to is a critical assessment of evidence. The tradition is willing to take things more or less at face value. If the tradition says that Abraham or that Adam in the Garden of Eden knew all of the mysteries of Jewish mysticism and that that's to be believed, the historian raises a skeptical eyebrow and questions whether or not that's a reliable or valid judgment. How do we know that something is true? Historians are skeptical and they assess evidence critically, trying to correlate the evidence and when correlate the evidence with other things going on. And if a historian discovers that the tradition claims one thing, but it turns out to be false, the historian doesn't dismiss things because the mistakes in history or false claims are as interesting as the things themselves. So I propose the historian's perspective to keep us away from passing judgment and keep us on the track more modestly of describing what Jewish mysticism is all about. Therefore, we need to start with the historian's framework. And I'll have recourse to this framework as we move along through the 10 lectures. Generally speaking, historians discern four distinct stages in the evolution of Jewish civilization or Jewish history. The first period coincides with the ancient Near Eastern period of our history. It's that period in which Israelite culture was formed and in which the Bible, the Old Testament, was produced. This period, and it's a matter of controversy when it begins, conservatively, let's say, about the year 1500 BC or BCE, in the middle of the second millennium, 2,000 years before the Common Era began. This ancient Near Eastern phase of Jewish history, coinciding with the great civilizations of Mesopotamia on one side and Egypt on the other, ended, from a historian's point of view, when new cultures arose in the ancient world that are associated with the Greco-Roman period. And this, roughly speaking, is the second century before the Common Era. So period number one, the ancient Near Eastern biblical phase, begins around the year 1500 and ends in the year approximately 200 and yields to the second phase of Jewish history, the Greco-Roman or the Rabbinic and Talmudic period. Historians generally give the dates of this second period from the conquest of Israel or Palestine, Judea, by Alexander the Great, until the conquest of the Middle East by the Islamic world in the 7th century. So we've got about 1,000 years which cover the period from the Greco-Roman period until the fall of that Greco-Roman civilization and the establishment of a new civilization, high mark, high water, in the history of our planet, with the Islamic world. That yields to period number three, according to the historians. Generally speaking, let's call it the medieval period. The medieval period begins in the 7th century with the conquest of Islam and goes all the way down to about the French Revolution or the American Revolution until the 18th century, when for all intents and purposes the forms and patterns of Jewish medieval life yield to the fourth period, which historians will call the modern period, beginning with the French-American revolutions and lasting down to our own day. So those are the four main phases of Jewish history. The ancient Near Eastern, which produced biblical literature, the second Greco-Roman, which produced a great variety of Jewish life, but which consolidated in something which came to be known and which is familiar to us today as Rabbinic or Talmudic Judaism. The third phase of Jewish history being the medieval, in which Jews lived as a minority in the majority culture of Islam or in medieval Christianity, and the fourth period, the modern, which lasts from the 18th century and is ongoing now. Some more qualities or distinguishing characteristics of each of these four periods. The ancient Near, what would be interesting to us as historians of religion about these four things, taking into account socio-political realities. The first phase is obviously the phase of the origin, the emergence of Israelite religion. And here it needs to be underscored and highlighted and underlined that if Israelite culture emerges around the year 1500, it comes relatively late in the history of culture. By the time the Israelite people confederated themselves into a single nation out of distinct tribes, human beings had already accomplished the great tasks of culture. People were no longer hunting and gathering. Urban civilization had been founded. Written languages had been invented. People had already had religions, beliefs in God, ways of writing, laws. All of the great achievements of civilization had already been accomplished by the time the Israelites emerge on the scene of history and respond to it, adopting and absorbing some of these great achievements, altering it according to its own spirit, and stamping its own personality on the ancient Near Eastern world. In the second period, the Jews are still interacting with the traditional peoples of the ancient Near Eastern world in the forms of the Greeks and the Romans. Essentially, they're interacting with people whose religions are like the religions out of which Israelite culture had emerged. Sometimes we use the word pagan to describe them, but that's not a very nice term. It's pejorative, and we're trying to avoid value judgments. The other term is usually polytheistic or mythopoeic. That in the second period, like the first period, Israelite culture is interacting with other nations who believe in many gods or many divinities, and Jewish civilization tends to identify itself with a rejection of polytheism and an affirmation of monotheism. Just one god, not many. In the medieval period, Judaism, the Israelite people, are now interacting with a very different sort of host cultures. Their neighbors are no longer pagans or polytheists. They're now interacting with religions like Christianity and Islam, who bear very close resemblance to Judaism itself, perhaps more so in the case of Christianity, whose Bible includes physically the identical books of the Jewish Old Testament, and Islam, to which in many ways bears resemblance, phenomenological resemblance to Judaism. Judaism is no longer interacting with polytheist traditions and cultures and people. It's interacting with monotheists, the Christians on the one side and Muslims on the other. And the relationship of the pagan polytheist traditions toward Judaism is certainly going to be very different than the interaction or the attitude of Muslims and Christians to the Jews in the Middle Ages. The socio-economic, political, cultural, and religious dynamics have shifted dramatically in the modern period, in the medieval period. And as for the modern period, Judaism is now interacting with something very different again. It's not interacting just with polytheists, people who believe in many gods. There are some of those still around, not many. It's certainly still interacting with other monotheists, but it's now interacting with traditions that it really had very little contact with up until the modern time. Buddhism, for example. A lot of very interesting examples of Jewish interaction with Buddhism and with Hinduism. But essentially, Jews in the modern period are interacting with secular cultures, secular, technological, Western, scientific peoples whose patterns of thought are very different than the traditional religious ones. And so at each phase of these four points of Jewish history, Jews are interacting with different kinds of culture, and that's going to affect the way their own internal beliefs and practices will unfold. And to just run down these four periods once more with some attention to socio-political realities, which might help set this, hopefully is setting the scene for the understanding of Jewish mysticism, Let me say that in the ancient Near Eastern period, the Jews were one people like all others interacting with them, a pesky competitor for empire building, for protecting borders. It's a nation like all others. Even in the Greco-Roman period, especially in the early stages, the Jews are a nation like all of the others interacting on the scene of history, affecting it in many ways, respected and feared as one nation like all of the others. But in the medieval period, all of that dramatically shifts. The Jews are no longer a nation living normally where nations live, predominantly in their own land, speaking their own language with their own borders. The Jews are now a dispersed people. They had been dispersed also in the biblical period, and they had been dispersed in the Greco-Roman period. But the dispersion of the Jews in those first two periods is different than the dispersion in the medieval period, because in the medieval period there was no homeland in possession of the Jews. It was a memory, it was a religious belief. But the dominant pattern of Jewish life was dispersion. The Jews were a minority living in a majority culture, and their existence as a minority is always going to be what minority existences are: precarious, vulnerable. The Jews survived, thrived, or suffered at the will or the whim or the good favor of the people in whose midst they lived. Jewish life in the Middle Ages was precarious. Interacting with the Christians and with the Muslims was very different than interacting with the Greeks and the Romans in the ancient period, or with the Egyptians in the biblical period. Jewish life was precarious, very precarious, diasporic. The Jews were not citizens in the lands in which they lived. They were tolerated there. The modern period changes all of that, and that justifies, perhaps if nothing else does, why the fourth period is so radically different than the other three. In the modern period, the Jew becomes enfranchised. The fight for civil rights and emancipation gives the Jew rights, legal rights, to exist in the lands of the world, whether they be in the Christian world or in the Islamic world. The fight for emancipation and modernization and westernization, which rests on the granting of civil rights to the Jews, citizenship in the lands in which they lived, is something brand new, something so new and so different that it alters all the conditions of Jewish belief and Jewish practice, radically and profoundly. It is as radical and profound a transformation as the medieval period was relative to the Greco-Roman one. To be a citizen of the Western lands in Europe or in America, and to feel that one belongs in this country, is very different than the sense of being a guest yearning to go home. In the modern period, the Jews are confronted with two sorts of things which are unlike anything that they ever had before, in keeping with the different set of circumstances. Modern Jewish history is marked by the Zionist movement, which leads to a return to the land of Israel and to the establishment of the state of Israel, which is a reality that the Jews had never had for a long, long time. And of course, Jewish history also in the modern period experiences the Holocaust, the genocidal war against the Jews in World War II, in which at least 6 million Jewish innocent people were murdered by the Nazis. There is no counterpart to either the reestablishment of the State of Israel or to the Holocaust in modernity in any other period of Jewish history, and we can't expect that Jewish belief and practice or patterns of identification in the modern period will be the same as the ones prior. And we can take the lesson from modernity and push them back, and push those lessons back into the other three periods as well. They are distinct cultural, political, and socioeconomic phases of Jewish life. Phases 1 and 2, the ancient Near Eastern and the Greco-Roman, the Jews are predominantly an agricultural, land-based people. From the medieval period on, there is an increasing urbanization of Jewish life. And I think we all intuitively know that the patterns of life of people living on the land are very different than the patterns of people living in urban centers, mixing with all sorts of different kinds of people, making their livings through urban activities and not as farmers or as shepherds. This is the historian's framework. And now what is all of this? What's the yield? Why bother learning all of this history? After all, what does it have to do with Jewish mysticism? So from the historian's point of view, the biblical period is characterized by religious intensity, wonderful institutions, powerful, dramatic institutions, like the temple in Jerusalem, where sacrifices are offered by the Levitical and priestly groups. Prophets have intense, immediate, intimate relationships with God, speaking God's word to the people, and joining the people to obey God's will, comforting them in their hour of need. Intense religiosity. But from the historian's point of view, all of the wonderful stuff that we read about in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, however religious and intense it might be, is not yet Jewish mysticism. The Bible is not a mystical book from a historian's point of view. It's intensely religious. Its chief characters are lawgivers and prophets and kings and sages, but not mystics, not yet. The second period, the Greco-Roman period, in which Rabbinic Judaism as we know it is founded, two central institutions that we'll speak about more in the second lecture are the synagogue, a place to worship and a place to study, under the leadership of the rabbis. From a historian's point of view, Rabbinic Judaism is intensely religious, profoundly religious, but it's not yet mystical. It's one of the preconditions, it's one of the raw elements, one of the components that, wrapped with the biblical literature and traditions and practices, would ultimately yield Jewish mysticism. But it's not yet Jewish mysticism. And I hope that will become clearer as we move along. From the historian's point of view, the medieval period is the place, the time, where Jewish mysticism, or Kabbalah, as the Jews themselves call it, Kabbalah meaning tradition, claiming that it went all the way back to the Bible and to rabbinic Talmudic literature, emerged. The first texts that we have which are clearly mystical in import and in meaning are 12th century. In southern France, Provence, and in Spain, it is in the medieval period that the Kabbalah emerges. Its raw materials, its component, its basic elements, drawing from the literary traditions of the Bible, hand in glove with the institutions, beliefs, and practices of Rabbinic Judaism, emerge. And from the historian's point of view, the fourth period is interesting for Jewish mysticism because some modern Jews will repudiate the mystical traditions in the name of their secularizing modern life as citizens in the nation state. And other Jews will hold on firmly to the mystical traditions as their weapon against the encroachments of secularizing Westernization. And about that I'll have more to say in the 10th lecture. So again, quickly, the four stages of Jewish history from the point of interest of a historian of Jewish mysticism: the ancient Near Eastern phase, biblical, intensely religious, not yet mystical. Phase two, the Greco-Roman rabbinic Talmudic tradition, where the foundations are laid, but not yet mystical. Third period, medieval, Jewish mysticism emerges. And in the fourth period, it undergoes some very profound transformations, being accepted, being rejected. Well, that's a partial answer to the question, what's Jewish about Jewish mysticism? I've suggested that it goes hand in glove with the overall contours of Jewish history. That apart from Jewish history, apart from the response of the Jews to their environment, there wouldn't be any Jewish mysticism. We wouldn't be able to understand it. Jewish mysticism is therefore Jewish in the sense that it is an embodiment or a precipitate of Jewish history. It's also Jewish in the sense that it goes hand in glove with the basic texts and practices and beliefs and social patterns of Jewish life. All of this will be spelled out as we go along in these lectures, but one of the main traditions of Jewish mysticism is an interpretation of why Jews do what they do. All of the laws, customs, and ceremonies that evolved out of biblical literature and which were elaborated by the rabbinic leaders, the basic practices are given meaning and significance by the Jewish mystics, so that the Jewish mystical ideas are rooted in everyday Jewish practice and given new meaning, given new life. One doesn't exist without the other. Jewish mysticism is Jewish in the sense that it conforms to, is inspired by, and lends new meaning to the traditions of the Bible and the rabbis. It's Jewish in that sense. Well, what is mystical about Jewish mysticism, having said something about what's Jewish about it, or at least indicating what's Jewish about it? What is mystical about it? Without taking too essentialist an approach to what mysticism is, being too deductive, giving a definition of what mysticism is and then finding it wherever it might appear, I think it might be better to think of mysticism as a scissors term. It's a judgment relative to something else. In a certain tradition that emphasizes the transcendence of God, and whose dominant metaphors, as my colleague Arthur Green keeps insisting, the dominant metaphors of a tradition in which the divine or God is up and out, that if you want to orient yourself to religious life, the place you orient toward is up and out. God is something transcendent. The divine is up there and out there. That in that kind of tradition of transcendence, mysticism will dialectically be the other pole. It will be a pole of interiority, or as Professor Arthur Green says, the dominant metaphors will be in and down. That in a tradition that emphasizes up and out, mysticism will be something perverse. It'll be contrary to the mainstream. It will deviate by emphasizing the other polarity. It will say that the divine, where the action really is, the place to orient in human life, is not up and out, but down and in. It'll be interiority. And it's been understood by some people that Judaism has no interiority, that it's a totally superficial external religion, always up and out. But Jewish mysticism proves the contrary. Dialectically responding to the transcendent upwardness and outwardness of the mainstream tradition, the mystics reinterpret or refashion the tradition to emphasize what it means to go down and in order to find the divine. What we usually associate only with Buddhism or with other Eastern traditions in which meditation, sinking into yourself in order to find the truth, also seems to turn up in the Jewish tradition as well. And so there is some general truth that religions in the West, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, tend to emphasize an outward and upward religion in which the divine is out there and hands down to us what we're supposed to do, as opposed to the Eastern religions, which in public relations terms are said to have no transcendence. Buddhism has no God, and where the main emphasis is on inwardness. That distinction really needs to be exploded. Because within Judaism, as within Christianity and Islam, there is this dialectical going down and in religious life. And that will be the mystic. Just as in the East, in the traditions that we think are totally immanent and anthropocentric, humanistic, not theistic, like Buddhism, we can find many forms which just look precisely like Judaism and Christianity and Islam in the West. Very external, very ritual, very much dependent on faith in some sort of a savior figure out there. So it's a loose rule of thumb, which is only useful moderately. Jewish mysticism is mystical in the sense that it focuses on interiority. And we can find that interiority in the East and in the West. We also can say that Jewish mysticism is mystical in the sense that it is characterized by a set of techniques for altering states of consciousness, or meditation techniques. And these meditation techniques for altering or dehabituating traditional states of mind are to be found equally distributed across all civilizations and throughout time. These meditation techniques are a supplement to the ordinary things that Jews regularly do, and their spirit infects and changes or transforms ordinary Jewish ritual belief. But the Jewish mystics will be identified always by a set of peculiar techniques which change the way their psyches, their consciousness works. So it's mystical in that sense, by its techniques. This leads to a third element of mystical, which will develop as time goes along, which, for lack of, it's just convenient to think of Freud and Jung as two explorers of the internal world and how our internal world expresses itself outwardly. Jewish mysticism is mystical because it seems to make sense in the psychological categories developed by Freud and Jung, but we'll develop that as time goes along. Finally, Jewish mysticism is mystical because of certain particular doctrines that it has, doctrines which it shares with normal garden variety Judaism, but other doctrines which distinguish it. One example will do. Most Jews would read the book of Job, and they would read it traditionally by saying in some way, Job was punished because he did some sort of a sin. The Jewish mystics would accept that there's some sort of sin, but they have a key to the book that no one else has. And if we read their interpretations, we find something quite strange or idiosyncratic that doctrinally marks Jewish mysticism off from the mainstream or from garden variety traditions. A mystical interpretation of the book of Job would say, yes, Job in this lifetime was a perfectly righteous man, as the Bible says. That's because in this life he was perfect. But the secret of the book of Job is not that he was being punished for sins in this life, but he was being punished for sins which his soul had committed in another life. And so Jewish mystics at a certain time and place who harbored the idea of the transmigration of souls brought that belief into traditional literature and read it in an entirely different way, a doctrine that was not widely shared by the rest of the tradition. Transmigration of souls would be the mystics' way of reading the book differently than regular Jews would. So there are doctrines which define and distinguish Jewish mystics from other Jews. And these different doctrines, together with the different practices, together with the meditation techniques, together with this preference for interiority, which seems to allow a Freudian or a Jungian psychoanalytic approach to things, are the elements which allow us to say that Jewish mysticism is mystical. It is interior. It has doctrines which are peculiar to it. It has practices which are peculiar to it. And in that way, it is mystical. So, what is Jewish about Jewish mysticism? That it's Jewish. It's a form of life created by the Jewish community. What is mystical about Jewish mysticism? Its resemblances to other traditions in which interiority is prominent, and in which doctrines are different, and in which meditation techniques lead to altered states of consciousness. What follows, then, are the next 9 lectures in which some of these ideas are worked out in much more specific detail. Thank you.